Psalm 5, likewise, is an appeal for justice. It's different, of course, and some of the moods will catch you. Some of these psalms you want to say in one mood and not in another. But the psalmist doesn't claim to be innocent, nor did the other one particularly, but it's important to notice that, and probably in your life like mine, if someone accuses you of doing something that's got nothing to do with anything you've ever done, I don't find that a problem, to be quite honest. I mean, it's not nice, but I kind of think, oh, well, you know, it's just wrong. You know, they've got a problem, in other words. So you get on with your life. But I imagine you're a bit like me. If someone actually accuses you of something and is distorted and exaggerated and right out of context and not true, but not entirely false either. You know, there's some grounds for the accusation in what you've said or done. So it's a quarter true. They're always a heck of a lot harder to handle, because you can't just say, oh, don't be stupid, because they're not being stupid. There's a reasons and grounds. In other words, you've got to look into yourself and sort that out a bit, obviously, even a lot. And anyhow, I find that kind of accusation really a lot harder to... Well, you shouldn't even dismiss it, should you? Because it shouldn't be dismissed, though it is wrong. Well, that's a bit like this psalm here. So let's see if we can see ourselves here. Psalm 5. Listen to my words, Yahweh. Give heed to my murmuring. Attend to the sound of my cry, my King and my God. For you, Yahweh, you are the one to whom I pray. Yahweh, always remember, Yahweh is a name for God, a personal name, not a title like the Lord, though it's usually translated the Lord in English translations, but that's straight from the Greek, kurios. But I think it's not a satisfactory translation at all. This is a personal name. And I know why people, the Jerusalem Bible and New Jerusalem Bible, use the word Yahweh, but some Jewish people are very sensitive to that, not wanting to use God's name, so they say Adonai, which means the Lord. And in sensitivity to them, it's a bit of a thing you've got to be a bit careful of. But if you're Jewish, and many Jews don't mind, by the way, using the word Yahweh, but some of the more scrupulous ones do, so it's a problem. But I'm using Yahweh throughout, because that's what the Hebrew has. Listen to my words, Yahweh. It's the God of Moses, it's the God of the Exodus, it's the Redeemer God, it's the Saving God, it's the God who in history has had us as his special possession and cared for us. It's got all that historical memory in it, whereas the Lord sounds a bit like a title of dignity or something. Attend to the sound of my cry, my King, my God. Look at the personal bit there. For you, Yahweh, are the one to whom I pray. In the morning, hear my voice. In the morning, I plead my case to you, watching and waiting. All you've got to know is a very simple truth, that the court in the Jewish city, Jerusalem, was held the only space they could do it, where there was a big space in front of the gates, inside the gates. That's the marketplace. That's the agora. That's where they gathered. And that's where they had the court before the day began. So in the morning means when the court case, when I'm accused and when the elders have to judge whether I'm guilty of stealing or adultery or could be anything or lie or, you know, whatever you're doing. Yeah. Well, then he wants God to be there in the morning and ensure that the judgment is in his favour, because it's actually an unjust accusation. Verse 4, he praises God for justice. For you, you're not the one who wills evil. The person who does evil is not your guest. Are you starting to think we better look at this a bit better? You remember how Jesus ate with sinners? So already we've got something in the psalm. There's an assumption there that's actually not right. Jesus shows us a more beautiful aspect of God. Yes, God hates sin, but never, never the sinner. The sinner is always welcome as God's guest. And you just look at the New Testament, it's full of it. But can you see how somebody brought up on this psalm, which is obvious, like everyone would say, of course, person who does evil is not God's guest. I mean, so obvious, no one thought to question it, till Jesus. So can you imagine them being shocked by Jesus' behaviour? Can you imagine them accusing him of it? Can you imagine him saying, you've got nothing to do with God, because if you were a holy person, you wouldn't let this woman touch you, you know, the woman who came in said to Luke chapter 7, and you don't know, he'd know what kind of manner of woman she is, they're saying. They've got it all wrong. But don't necessarily blame them. This psalmist, this beautiful author here, and the people were singing it for years. People are still singing it. So can you see why, how dangerous it is to just take the Old Testament as God's word, abstract, true, complete, without Jesus? So here it is. The boastful will not stand. There's a truth in it that you can get to, but you've got to go a bit deeper to get the truth. The boastful will not stand before you. You detest those who do evil. No. You detest the evil they do. You don't detest those who do evil. You destroy those who lie. Look around. Oh dear, I won't get into politics again, but really, God doesn't come in and destroy it all, because God doesn't control the world. I've got to get back to that. God isn't the Passion of the Christ by, who was that Australian author who got that out? Yes. Mel Gibson, who, whatever you think of it, and you've got opinions, you're welcome to your opinion, of course. I think it's an atrocious film as far as God goes, because in the end, God actually comes in like a big... and bombs the whole place. An earthquake and the temple falls apart. And in the end, God goes, and in Iraq, you know, we've got bigger bombs. God's got bigger bombs than us. That's what it comes to. So the God behind that film was not the God of Jesus, but the God of... Mel Gibson, oh well, whatever, yeah. And the woman whom he read, by the way, is being beatified, so I don't know what beatification has become, an absolute puzzle to me. I don't know what it's got to do with holiness sometimes, money sometimes, I don't know what it's about. Anyhow, it doesn't matter that I don't know, the chances of us being beatified are probably fairly minimal. But you certainly don't get beatified without money, so... some problem going on. I don't mean to be too cynical, just the fact that's how it is. And there are beautiful, holy people who've been beatified, of course. Enough. You destroy those who lie, Yahweh. You abhor the bloodthirsty and deceitful. Well, basically that's not true. Jesus showed us another God who never stops loving the sinner. The father of the prodigal son who loved that boy and kept waiting for him. The problem is not God, we did this a bit last week with God's anger. The problem isn't that God stops loving me when I sin. In fact, that's the absolute wrong error. The problem is that when I sin, I choose not to welcome God's love. So, I don't welcome it, so it doesn't get to me. So I haven't got it. I'm in the pig yard, unless I come home again. So I'm in the dark. Yes, the dark's real, but the dark is not produced by God. The dark is produced by me turning off the lights or pulling the blinds. So that's what Jesus taught us, thanks be to God. And this author, lovely as he is, and there's a beautiful kind of feelings in it, didn't know that, and you can't blame him for not knowing it. But the fact that it's in the Bible doesn't mean it's equally true with what Jesus showed. Have you got that message? It's an imperfect, inspired, and so you've got to look for the truth in it, but it won't all be there. Verse 7, I, thanks to your great kindness, that's Chesed, the word I spoke about early, H-E-S-E-D with a little dot under the H, Chesed. Thanks to your great kindness, I have access to your house and I bow down towards your holy temple in awe of you. So this person's in Jerusalem. He's able to go to the temple, and in that beautiful place that aspires to God, he's able to be in communion with God in a place of covenant love. That word kindness there I've already read it, but I'll read it again. Exodus chapter 34, 6. That's another one of the key traits of God in that creedal statement. Yahweh, a God tenderly compassionate, gracious, we saw gracious, slow to anger, we talked about anger last week, and abounding in kindness, saving kindness, loving kindness, but kindness, that's it. Verse 8. They speak evil of me. This is the problem he's facing. And if someone speaks evil of you, you might want to go to Psalm 4 or Psalm 5 and realize you're not the only one it's ever happened to, and you might find some comfort in that. And if anyone hasn't ever spoken evil about any of us, I don't know what's gone on. You have just been fortunate you haven't heard it. Because I presume people seem to do this kind of thing. They speak evil of me. In your justice be my guide, Yahweh. Make clear your way before me. A lovely line. No wonder they kept it. Make clear, what am I to do? Which way will I go? Well, you show me the way to go. It might be to steer clear of that person, because you don't fight a lion unless there's a back gate to the dash thing. You know, you don't go into a great Dane with its teeth bared and say, behave yourself. You might be better to stay outside the gate. Well, there are people like great Danes in our life sometimes, so there might be the best thing to do a bit of duck, or to find another door into the sacristy and come out the other way to the presbytery. I don't know what you... Or the way to do it might be to ring that person up, or to confront them, you know? I mean, there's all kinds of ways of doing things. And so this man's asking, show me your way to deal with this. Silence, avoidance, confrontation, they're all good. Just which one is good needs discernment. And then he continues in verse 9. In this case, he's pleading that the enemies will be condemned. Unlike verse 4, he's not asking whether they'll change or not. That hasn't occurred to him, I'd say. He just wants them to back off and suffer the consequence. Oh, look what it says. There's no truth in their mouths. There's nothing inside but an empty cavern. So their mouths don't speak truth, and inside is just a hollow emptiness. Their throats are open graves, and all honey their speech. Oh, they're very charming, they're very lovely, they're very gentle. They've always got this beautiful smile. But their words are like bloody daggers, you know, like there's something else going on underneath the smile. And just for your interest only, the Hebrew word, see for the word inside, there's nothing inside. The Hebrew word there is kereb. Their throats are open graves. The Hebrew word is keber. Kereb, keber. So you can't pick that up in English. But you see, in as you'd expect, in Hebrew, there's a lot of poetic allusions and assonance and rhyming, and I'll do a bit more for you later on that. That's there. And as I said last week, a psalm means something played to a harp. So if I was reading this now and you also had a wonderful musician, which I'm sure some of you are, with a harp, you'd be enjoying it more beautifully, wouldn't you? I mean, the music would lift you and take another part of you into it. So we're trying to do our best I'm doing talking all the time, but imagine a harp behind this would just give it such a... And it should be played with a harp. That's why it's called a psalm. So if you've got a harpist in your parish, don't ever read the responsorial psalm. Get the harpist to play. Get music into it. It's not another reading. You'll have four readings if you don't watch it. First reading, second reading, gospel. And by the end, if you look at people, they're all gone. And you say, well, as it said in the second reading, and I'm thinking to myself, the priest, and I've been reading this stuff the week before, prepared a homily. And I can't. And I think, what was the second reading? Like, it's just too much. Anyhow, there we are. For there is no truth in their mouths. There's nothing kereb inside but an empty cavern. Their throats are keber, graves, just open graves. Death coming out. It's all about, it's not life-giving. All honey their speech. So, verse 10, make them suffer the consequences of their sin. A perfect line and a good reminder to us. He's not saying, God, ultimately, God isn't doing the punishing. I punish myself, you see. I suffer the consequence of my sin. When we do badly, we suffer the consequences of it. Don't blame God or anybody else for it. Oh God, bring to nothing their plotting, because of their many transgressions, cast them out, for they rebel against you. Cast them out, for they rebel against you. And then Jesus comes in and says to the person praying the psalm, listen, darling, we can improve on that. How about loving them out of it? Oh no. How about loving your enemies? How about loving those who persecute you? How about loving those who... Now, it may not work. They may crucify you, Jesus is saying, because actually I'm fairly sure that's what's going to happen to me. But don't you stop loving, because if you respond the way they're behaving, you're letting them control your heart as well as everything else. They've actually got too much control over you. Stay loving. Stay a disciple of Jesus in the worst situation is the way to go. That's the way of God, says Jesus. Well, you can't expect this poor psalmist to have known that. Do you see what I'm trying to reinforce for you? The limits of the psalms as well as what's beautiful in them. I need to say a moment, and this is a bit erudite and perhaps a bit refined. He uses the word sin there, and he uses the word transgression. See it? You can see it, of course. They're slightly different. And I'll try and give you the essential nuance. A sin, in the biblical sense, in the Hebrew there, is an offence committed against someone with whom you have a relationship. And it includes the consequences of that offence. So when you use the word sin, I can't say in English, but I'm talking about as it'll appear in all these psalms, the Hebrew word, it assumes that you're actually offending against someone with whom you're in a relationship. So it's always got that lovely quality about it. The word transgression doesn't imply a relationship, and it's actually something pretty much worse. Transgression has in it, it provokes outrage and threatens serious sanctions. So when I use the word, and I'll keep it consistent through my translations, the word transgression is a dreadful thing to do. Like it's just not a slip up. It's really dreadful. And by law, there are serious sanctions against it. And if anyone sees it happen, they're outraged by it. So it's a very strong word. And let's conclude the psalm. Verse 11, let all who take refuge in you rejoice. Forever let them sing for joy. Spread your protection over them so that those who love your name may exult in you. The expression love your name occurs only twice in the whole Bible. Here, in our psalm, and in a text I'll now read for you, Isaiah chapter 56, verse 6. So it's a rare expression, twice in the Bible, to love your name. Basically it means to love calling on you, to love inviting you, to love speaking with you, you know. It's not directly love you, of course it implies that, and there's many times when we're told to love Yahweh, but this is loving to call upon your name kind of thing. And this is the text from Isaiah. The foreigners who join themselves to Yahweh, to minister to him, to love the name of Yahweh, in other words, love singing and praying, and to be his servants, all who keep the Sabbath and do not profane it and hold fast my covenant, these I will bring to my holy mountain. I will make them joyful in my house of prayer. Their burnt offerings, their sacrifices will be accepted on my altar. And this has to be said. These are the disciples of the after the return from exile, because the priests were saying they're not welcome. You're outside, you're locked out. Get rid of your Moabite wives, your foreigners. What we've got to do is become a nice little denomination that's tight and the way we were, strong and put fin and you know, and there's a bit of self-protection. It's a ghetto mentality, but it's in the time. And these prophets are writing out again, saying, no, forget what you're hearing. God's not like that. God is saying, their sacrifices will be accepted on my altar. Why? Because my house shall be called a house of prayer for all the peoples, See, it's that universal view, which is right from the beginning. It's always there, but it was, as with us, as with anybody, people tend to become small, and when they're under attack, God becomes too small. Christianity becomes too moralistic and too small. It's a danger of any group, because you've got to be as big as the cosmos to be anything to do with God. Well, there I'll conclude. Verse 12. The reference is Isaiah 56, verse 6. For you bless the just, Yahweh. You cover them from above, like a tent. You surround them with the shield of your goodness. So God is protecting us from the heat of the sun, as it were, and like a shield, protecting us from danger. Yes, there has to be a truth in that, but the truth is fairly subtle. Jesus wasn't too protected. Do you know, you've got to think it deeply. It's ultimately true, we would see. He was hoping it was kind of true in the short term too, but I think reality doesn't say that. You might pray all day and still have a road accident because I'm driving carelessly and I crash into you. So by all means pray, but ultimately all our prayer is that God will grace us, that we can respond lovingly to whatever happens. I think that's our only real prayer.